philosophers in space, 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 space.
Oops, ain't gonna cut it, Mr. Glowing Visage, beautiful beyond all description.
These are my disposables, exposition and comic relief.
No functions.
Darling, those are genders.
I would like to see the baby.
If it makes you feel any better, the apocalypse is coming soon. Bury your gold. You've been buying gold, right?
Hello and welcome to Philosophers in Space. I am a garlic-related bagel. Joining me is some other spices to make the everything bagel. How are you doing, Aaron?
I'm pretty salty, as usual. No, I'm excited. I'm here to squeegee my googly third eye. How about you, Jesse?
Oh, shit. I'm more of a bialy than a bagel sometimes. Just thought I'd throw in a deli-related joke.
I was going to say, I don't know what that is. Sorry. I'm
sorry. Bialy is like...
It's okay. He lost Bialy all the Gentiles. It's fine.
Yeah. I'm a California Gentile.
How can you not know a Bialy? A Bialy is like a bagel without a hole and some roasty onions on top. Very, very good.
This kills in the Jew universes, trust me.
I was going to say, to answer your question of how could I not know that, I'm not Jewish and raised in a small town in California, so, you know.
I'm just trying to get Kanye's attention here.
Yeah, no, I do love that they picked the bagel.
He's right behind you.
As a symbol. I'm glad that they did a subtle nod in this movie to the fact that Jews control the universe with the bagel. It's a good tip off.
God, that's right. Yeah, what a giveaway.
What a giveaway.
Yeah, it wasn't like the everything bangers and mash of, I'm trying to think, I don't know what else you would have done. The British Empire maybe controls everything, I don't know.
Right. What do lizard people eat? What are the reptilians eat?
Bugs.
Oh, right. Children's blood, obviously. Yeah.
And that's also
where have
Jews.
I been?
Yeah. you've right. taught me that's all still just Jews
it's just
with
Jews
more steps.
All the way down. Yeah. Yep. Eventually it's just Atlantis Jews. I'm just Jew bullshitting at this point, but
that's fine.
True story. I got LASIK just recently. Ooh. Folks. So I have laser eyes now. And as I was preparing to convalesce, I was picking all of the like things I was going to listen to in case it like took a while for my eyes to come back. And one of the things I picked is my ultimate happy place, which is the Hollow Earth episode of Be Reasonable, which has the best hard pivot into Jewish conspiracism in any recorded thing ever. I just can never, ever recommend this piece of content enough for the funniest 30 minutes pivot ever. Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah. LASIK. You're merging more with technology, maybe. Well, I don't know. Would you call that merging with technology? I guess you got your. I used to say I got my eyeballs lasered. I did it, 5 years ago. I love it. Never regretted it. Anyone who thinks there's some downside, like you can't see at night or something, that's bullshit. It's great. It's fantastic.
Well, it might be for some people, I think results vary, right?
Possibly, but
I've certainly experienced it as technology equals magic in this context.
Yeah. In my experience, people tend to take like a reported downside that happened with 0.01% of people and just say like, oh yeah. And then that happens to you. Right. And it's like, no, it doesn't.
Yeah, no, it's pretty freaky how effective. Yeah,
to explore your LASIK more. So why don't you tell us more about... No, we're here for Everything Everywhere.
We're here to open everyone's third eye with LASIK. We're going to LASIK in the middle of your forehead, and that third eye is going to pop right open.
Good question. Let's say you're nearsighted,
and
you spring a third eye. Is the third eye... do you need glasses for that eye, too? Will it also have those challenges?
I think it's a separate sense, so I think it overcompensates and it's like extra open.
But will you be like near psychic sighted or something? Somehow the nearsightedness will still apply, but to the psychic power that is the third eye. Food for thought?
Right.
We're asking the questions one else is. Everything Everywhere All at Once, part two. This feels like we did part one, 10 years ago. So since then, I think Jess has watched the movie 18 more times. To be fresh.
I still can't narrate the plot, so saddling me with exposition. It's a terrible,
I thought you were so great last time. What are you, what
are okay, and language there, Padre, on the main show.
You were incredible last time. What are you talking about?
Yeah.
You're great. This is...
Wait, the F word on the main show? Really?
Mm. Yeah, yeah. We keep it PG in case, you know, the students, you know, in case you're going to play it in some kid's setting or something.
Yeah, we're a big hit in kindergarten classrooms.
After dark. Yeah. Hey, you know, some of us try to make educational content for wide ranges of people. It's no big deal.
Okay. I don't know how young your demographic is.
Pretty cool that you got to pull a whole, hey, language with your own dad. That's cool.
Right.
That's right. That's right. Just save it for the after dark. You know, we try to be a little business up.
Kiss
front,
my mother with that
back.
Mouth.
What the freak are you talking about?
All right.
That's right. Language, dude.
Will we finally get to the content? One way or the other, we should jump into the exposition zone and then draw, I don't know, straws to see who's going to actually do it. We just drew straws. We all drew the shortest one. So all three of us need to exposition. So why don't we go ahead and bop it.
You're traveling through another dimension beyond that which is known to podcasters. It is the middle ground between fair use and copyright infringement, between ordinary fanboying and meaningful analysis. It is the exposition zone.
All right, here we are in
the
Everything
Bagel. We can free associate the way the movie does, basically.
Yeah, we are three rocks in the universe of... You know, I'll be honest, I didn't really like that part.
Really?
I'm going to come right out and say it.
That was...
Wait, you don't
that
like
was the part where,
world?
Where like the bottom dropped out for me. I'll be honest.
Oh my god!
I don't like
You're
the rock
kidding
part.
Me.
I
Holy
look.
Moly.
I'm a
What's
stickler.
The with you,
I feel like they could have made it more sense. Make more sense. It's weird to posit a universe in which there's no consciousness and then have things talk to each other. I don't get it. Doesn't make sense to me.
Oh, I think it's perfect. I have all kinds of material about that.
This is the concreteness problem coming up again, I think.
Right. Talk about rocks. When we get to it, I've got content on the rock world. Jeez, I freaking love the rock world.
Yeah. To me, the rock world was one of the biggest moments where I was genuinely blown away at the like that was one of the moments where I felt like it went beyond like Rick and Morty in an impressive way, I thought. But yeah.
Interesting. Well, where are we in our plot? Does anyone remember?
Yeah, we were at the bagel. I think we were pretty much mid-bagel. Like, she was, Jobu was pitching the kind of nihilist out, and Mom was resisting, and then we get those, like, series of multi-world flashes. I think we get some of the, like, really best dialogue in the whole movie between her and the alternate world Wayland. Nobody on that one.
Wayland? Oh, are you talking about Waymond?
Yeah, Waymond. Right.
Okay, that's Waymond, so delightful. Yeah, you don't try to do this, right?
I just totally random, yeah.
Like, you couldn't write... If this was an ongoing bit, you wouldn't be able to write it this accurately.
No, I'm not a good writer at all, for
like
starters.
Like, that you would be able to get every name just one letter off at all times. It's really cool.
It's not off in my universe. It's just off in your universe.
Okay, that's fair.
Okay, so go with that. Like, so what did you mean by the vignettes that came after that? Because I can never remember the sequencing in this film.
Yeah.
It's too damn chaotic. But what are you talking about?
I don't think like the sequencing is like it's not important that we go like literally step by step through this. But I think conceptually, with a couple of key vignettes, what we can say is, you know, there's like an offer on the table where she brings her to the bagel world, which is one of the best designed sequences.
Do
in
love
my
it.
Opinion,
I did love that part. Yeah.
The costumes, the masks on like the people's heads and stuff. Yeah. The like the kind of vaguely Catholic churchy, I think, kind of vibe with a sort of it almost reminds me a little bit of like the Ark of the Covenant. Right.
And, Raiders. Yeah.
A bit of a yeah. So. And that's, you know, in Jewish tradition, there's the like the tabernacle or whatever. I'm probably getting all the words wrong here now, but there's like this idea that the Torah is kept in this sacred place within the temple and where God resides.
Ooh, and sure. This is a good opportunity to say definitely Lovecraftian, right? Versus
yes,
the other thing.
Right,
Ian.
Right.
Yeah.
Strong Lovecraft here, yes. For sure. Especially in the like Jobu also is a very Lovecraftian god kind of creature, kind of chaos incarnate, you know, devoid of a coherent motivation, but sort of generating a reality around it, kind of very Azathothian in that way. Yeah, and I like the bagel a lot as this kind of the black symbol, as a very Lovecraftian symbol that also reminds me of the circles in Arrival, the like language that they use to communicate with. Maybe we can talk a little bit about the circle some after dark. But yeah, so we have this like offer of, let you know, I found, you know, this person who is almost like me. Let's go in the bagel and not exist together. But the mom is sort of torn and wants to kind of stay attached to the world, which I think is one of the really important like discourses, dialogues in this and the Buddhist philosophy stuff of like attachment versus non-attachment in the world versus escaping from the world. Sure. There's this like back and forth where she's like physically like turning away from the bagel and Jobu's trying to turn her back. And that's where I think you do get some of the vignettes that are like her at the party where she meets the alternate world husband and they like share a cigarette and talk in the alley outside.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Wayland, we know.
yeah, right. So like, do you get much out of those moments though? Like that, like everything from here onward to me really hit me like a truck to varying degrees, but I certainly think the conversation with them in the alley and then the stone, like the rock stuff on top of that and the fight scene, that's the other one, is that we have this like sequence where they fight each other across a bunch of different like dimensions as well, right? They like turn into pinatas and stuff, and there's all of these beautiful absurdist elements that I think come together, but it's contrasted with this very human dialogue about, you know, like I would have been happy, that one line that really always gets me is that, you know, I would have been happy just doing laundry and taxes with you.
Yeah, I what I key on in the second half is when Evelyn tries out rejecting everything the way Jobu Tapaki / Joy is encouraging her to. There's a whole sequence. She kills Waymond in one of the vignettes, shivs him with a blade in one of the vignettes. She exposes the other Japanese chef for having the raccoon on his head. She basically, you know, for somebody who has been trying to follow the rules and trying to prove herself as a success in the worldly world, she really does try to break all the rules and to break all of her attachments. I mean, in that way, Joy or Jobu is kind of a Lucifer character, exhorting Evelyn to a kind of freedom that Evelyn hasn't allowed herself. And so she kills Wayman, she rejects Jamie Lee in the hot dog world, breaks her heart, she unmasks the raccoon chef, she signs Wayman's divorce order. Like she does all of that, which is all a kind of adolescent awakening. You know, adolescents get off on calling bullshit on everything that they've previously conformed to. And that's sort of what Evelyn does in that whole sequence, is she tries all of that breaking of attachments on, but in the most adolescent possible way, just to break all of the attachments. That was kind of what struck me in that middle sequence.
Yeah, and I think I've talked before about one version of Buddhist enlightenment where it's this kind of, once you become enlightened and you recognize the truth of non-attachment, you can then do actions that previously would have been horrible ethical violations, but they're not because you're doing it on the path to helping everyone become enlightened or something like that. Mm. And I think you could see sort of that as an early stage of her. I don't necessarily think it's the only way to interpret it, but it is one thing that comes to mind for me in the ways of like, if we imagine this middle sequence as like, she's seen the bagel and it's now, what are the different ways you try solving that? And one of them could be this kind of, you know, radical rejection of all of the ethical principles that you previously adopted as a way to show that like, even those principles are transcended in sort of non-dualism or something, that, you know, there's some stories like that. But I also think that like it is you know, also the kind of nihilism slide that we were talking about as well, where you just, you know, you feel unmotivated to do the things, and you feel like detached from the very concept, I think, of being motivated to do things on a like almost meta level, that kind of the idea that it kind of cuts it off across all of these universes.
Also, do you think it's more than just nihilism? Because it's also like smashing things, you know, like it's one thing to be like, nothing matters, I'm going to take a nap. No, is it slightly different to be like, I'm going to destroy these things, you know? What's going on there?
Well, I guess I feel like anger to me is a reaction that sometimes people have to nihilism, or that like the destruction. Yeah, I don't know.
Or like,
I feel
because
like
it doesn't matter, might as well like just kind of F around kind of thing, or like destroy these things to show they don't matter, maybe.
Yeah, or I think arguably in those moments, there's a bit of hedonism there too, where it's like all of the things that she's resisted doing, she gets drunk, she smashes the window of her own store, like she, you know, embarrasses her family. It's a kind of cutting loose from, you know, morally speaking, in a way that I think feels momentarily pleasurable. And then when it ends up, you know, very quickly feeling empty, that's when she turns into the Rock, you know? And I think I really love that.
Not Dwayne
moment.
The Rock Johnson,
and,
by the way, for people who didn't watch
movie. Obviously.
She could. Like not that much more silly and absurdist than what did happen. If they go to a universe and she is Dwayne
choice.
The Rock Johnson. Yeah.
In such in a movie that is like, you know, the way my mom once described Moulin Rouge is like being inside of a kaleidoscope. Like this movie is like being trapped inside of a moving kaleidoscope. And at the same time, these moments are such a beautiful moment of stillness in the midst of all of that. And it goes so minimal in terms of the text. But I find the text through those sequences so rich. Like I think that's where you see like some of, again, just like in the alley, you see, I think, some of the most rich conversations.
Mm-hmm. No question. I mean, the conversation she has with Joy as the Rocks is gorgeous. It's the first time they have a breakthrough of real understanding and tenderness with each other in the peacefulness of that world. That's what I love about that sequence in the world, is they're both suffering from the multiplicity of identities, the multiplicity of universes. And so they go into Rock World, and there's that beautiful quiet, beautiful peacefulness, you know, which is a kind of a cure for the multiplicity. And that's one of the themes in the movie, is all of the identity confusion that people have, all of the splits that people have between the old world and the new world, you know, Evelyn's father and her. Joy and Evelyn are split because Joy embodies an identity that Evelyn can't sync with her traditional ideas of roles and identities. So that suffering, one of the cures for that suffering is to go into essentially emptiness or peace. It's a little bit different from the adolescent nihilistic breaking of everything that precedes it. You know, where, as you say, she breaks every rule that she can. She behaves cruelly. She, you know, she acts out of role, you know, which is a part of awakening. You know,
I mean,
it's a little bit of an adolescent phase. You know, it's sort of anti everything as opposed to pro something.
Yeah. And I like the Rocks as a next phase, because I feel like at every level of this, we're getting both kind of a traditional Buddhist concept of enlightenment, but also a critique of it. Mm-hmm. So like there is a strain, I think, of these kind of enlightenment approaches that is essentially be the Rock, you know, like not Dwayne again, but you could also be Dwayne too, right? But
I've been doing it wrong. Okay. No wonder I didn't reach enlightenment.
It, you know, since this movie is references all the way down, I don't feel bad making all explanations also be references. And in this case, I think of I Heart Huckabee and the monologue about the Rock and how you just sit there and be a rock.
Another reference, I don't know. Dang.
Oh,
is I Heart Huckabee available in Jewish delis in New York? Is that where you get it? Or I just wonder
if
why
we
I
let
don't,
you.
Yep.
If, I don't if know we it. Let you.
They're all part of the same East Coast starter pack. So the becoming the Rock, but also as an escapist kind of thing. I think the critique here is that actually enlightenment, or is that just running as far away from an attachment as you can? Where the like smashing the mirrors is still a kind of attachment. I think Thomas is right that it's like an attachment to the pleasure of just doing whatever you want. This is a like, I just want to be away from all of it. I want to be free of all of the feelings, all of the attachments and stuff. And that sort of this is the kind of view from nowhere question a little bit about like when you get all the way out there, you know, can you really get away from attachment, or are you still feeling something? And, you know, otherwise, is there just not a you then, or something like that, I guess.
I just think it's a very partial, incomplete step, you know, what non-attachment does in that frame is it allows you to break out of the stuck role patterns and the stuck ideologies that you think make you who you are. So you do have to shed those and find this kind of holy emptiness. That's true. But as Evelyn does in the film, you have to come back to the world. And you have to have a reason for coming back to the world.
Bonnie, I think we established last time. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Well, we see the beginnings of her coming back to the world, I think, begin with her seeing how Wayman seduces people with love, how he seduces people with cheerfulness, absurdism. You know, I think this is where Aaron, I thought, made a good point last time, that absurdism plays a big role in that third part, because Wayman, he sees all the problems in life, but he also brings a lot of love and humor to them. And I think that's what begins to draw Evelyn back in, is kind of seeing how beautifully he does that.
This is the last part.
One way of thinking about Buddhism is that it has two wings. One wing is clarity or mindfulness, the ability to see things exactly as they are and to see through them. The other wing is the path of heart, which I talked about last time, that without the path of heart, what you have is that kind of cold, nihilistic, nothing really matters because everything is an illusion. And I don't think that's someplace where you can actually live. I think you can live out your life that way.
I agree. I do think these things are in tension to some extent, that it's not purely an illusory tension. But I agree with you that I think that tension is key to this last part. I was going to mention the last little bit of the Rock thing that I think is really valuable, is that's where we get this idea about this, like, every new discovery makes us realize how kind of small and stupid we are. And it's this kind of the one part you were saying there about, you know, clarity. The more we understand, the more we introspect, the more we learn about our minds, there is a sense in which, you know, in the like Nagel moral luck, you know, the sense of self shrinks and shrinks and shrinks. And that can make people feel small and stupid and the product of circumstances and not under their own control in ways that can be really upsetting.
Sure.
And I agree that that has to then be contrasted with the, like, you know, Wayman's response of, you know, you think I'm weak because of the way that, like, there's a very yin-yang sort of concept here that sometimes you see this kind of thing portrayed in the fighting itself. And you do see that in her final kind of approach, where it's like, you know, the switch from, like, the hard to the soft style, as, like, his sort of whole conception of how to approach the world is to be soft and kind, you know, in a silly kind of way, where everything around him is very hard and rough.
Yes.
I think it's just so funny how the different ways that we watched this movie, because as we established last time, I mean, I'm thinking it's funny how keyed in you are on the main character in this thing. Like, in the Rock scene, I also see it as, like, to begin any sort of healing process, if you wanted to do that, which I don't know why Joy should want to, she probably shouldn't, in my opinion, but if you wanted to, one phase of that seems to me would be getting to the point where you're having to, like, kind of not forget, but set aside the past harm that this person has caused you. And I think the Rock scene shows that. It's kind of like, It's just funny the things we focused on. Like I focus on like, okay, I guess maybe if you're in that state, that's finally a point where like the way that the daughter is talking is much different. It's not like the Jobu blah 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 whatever. She's not really like a villain anymore. She's kind of stripped of all that stuff. And maybe in that universe, she's able to like set kind of that pain aside a little bit, and that's kind of where the healing can start of no that question. Relationship.
Well, there's a quote that I think it might be, you know, we can debate this, but I think it kind of lays out the perspective that maybe you're struggling with here. This is
I was just saying I like keyed in on different components than you guys is all I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sorry. I mean, yeah, I agree that like we key on different components, but I also think that like this is sort of part of the dialogue in the movie itself, because I think there's this line in those sequences in the alley where he says, you know, he's sort of explaining, he's responding to that, you know, you think I'm weak kind of idea. And he says, you tell me it's a cruel world and that we're all just running around in circles. You're fighting because you're scared and confused. I'm confused too. When I choose to see the good side of things, I'm not being naive. I'm being strategic and necessary to survive. The only thing I do know is that we have to be kind, especially when we don't know what's going on. This is how I fight. Please be kind. And yes. You know, I get what you're saying, and I also think there is something to the idea that this is an approach that could be ethical. It can't always be successful, but I don't think it's like fundamentally sort of immoral, potentially, in a way that I think some folks might see it as like, you know, oh, you're not holding people accountable or something.
Well, I mean, that's just totally different person and a different scene than what I was talking about. I don't know. I was talking about just the rocks between the daughter and the mom.
I know, but all these things are interspersed together. And I'm talking about your specific concern about how we engage with the cruelty of life. And I thought that his response there, or that his quote, that quote there is a, you know, useful piece in this back and forth.
I love Wayman. He's my favorite. He's my favorite character of this whole thing. And I thought that those scenes were some of my favorite when he, because I do, that's something I very much believe. Like, honestly, that's something that as a parent has been a real, I don't know if it's a mindset shift, but like it's seeing, whereas I think a lot of, you know, our culture and toxic masculinity wants, mm-hmm. pushes men to be a certain way. And I think that as a parent, I think that there is a strength in kindness that maybe, you know, is not as apparent, as obvious when you're a kid or when you're a young man and you have all these pressures on you. And mm-hmm. That's something that I loved, that component of the movie I really enjoyed.
So that's interesting to me, because to me it seems like his solution is, you know, teaching other people about luck in a sense. So he, you know, he gets Jamie Lee Curtis to stop being angry at his wife by talking about her circumstantial luck, about the fact that they're going through this, you know, maybe getting divorced situation. And that leads to the kind of cascading realization about lovability, this idea that you're not unlovable, you know, just because you've harmed others in a moment of bad luck or weakness, right? And it's, I think it is hard to hold on to that idea and not end up in a similar place that like the main characters end up with regard to the mother, in terms of, you know, still wanting to sort of be in connection with her and helping her in this kind of journey of being less, you know, damaged and damaging towards others. So then we get this like final sequence, right, which is this great... This reminded me a lot, actually, of Kung Fu Hustle, the like mm-hmm. enlightened love style combat of, and specifically of the googly third eyes and mm-hmm. I like the element in particular where they add in that the moves are in specific relation to the needs of the individuals in their own specific worlds that they have, you know, these histories. So it's like the corrective to everyone's, you know, histories of bad luck is, you know, giving them the thing they need so that they feel complete in these kinds of ways.
Yeah, which is dependent on empathy. Like, that's the thing that Evelyn can then do, is she can, you know, she looks at the guy and she sees his x-ray and thinks about what's wrong with his neck. Like, she can see the lack and the pain in each person, and she provides the corrective to it. You know, she's broken through into empathy at this point, which was, you know, not a part of her repertoire to begin with, because she was acting out, you know, stuck roles. And now she... you know, she is able to see into each different person and provide empathy to them and love to them. And that, you know, that makes this tremendous difference. You know, that's a joining kind of corrective to people, as opposed to telling them what to do or telling them to get back in role, you know, or fighting them for that matter.
So she, I love the Rakakuni stuff as a perfect example of that, where she, you know, moves from controlling him like the Rakakuni to being his, you know, him being on top is a great absurdist version of that.
That's,
I also like
Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, I like the little bit of detail of, like, when she does these things to them, she also knocks off the headsets, which not only sort of takes away their ability to fight, but to me is a great symbol of, like, removing someone from samsara, these sort of cycles of connection and attachment, in this case to, we're like, if the multiverse is kind of the universe of possibilities that we're attached to, that we feel suffering because we don't get to act out those parts of the universe, you know, she frees them from that like suffering of not getting to have those things.
It's interesting. It's early in the film when we see Jenny Slate come to get her laundry. There's a sequence where she's trying to talk to Evelyn while she's talking to, I guess, her boyfriend on her earpiece. And it's a glimpse of those earpieces. Again, she's talking to her boyfriend. She's being inconsiderate to Evelyn, because she's talking on the one hand, you know, she's split in this world of multiple identities where we're all kind of split with chaos and we're all suffering because we're alienated from each other. Those earpieces kind of in some ways symbolize that.
Oh, yeah, and I like that.
But I was also going to say that when she shifts into the pleasurable fighting style, the loving, humorous fighting style, it's also a reaction against her father, who in that second half of the film comes to represent totalitarian control, you know? He's all about black-white thinking, which is very different from what Joy teaches her. Joy has that lovely little monologue as Jobu about how right and wrong are just concepts that fearful people create, you know? Whereas Alpha Gong Gong is very black-white. Jobu is bad, and you have to kill her in every universe that you find her in, you know, which is a lot like, he's a symbol of a sort of totalitarian patriarchal society that demands a very strict control, roles and control. And she really breaks that.
I'm so glad you said that. That was one of the things I was looking forward to, maybe you guys, you know, telling me what this was, because I didn't quite pick up on what they're going for with his character. Now that you say it, I think the machinery that he ends up in at the end, it maybe it is because of, like, his binary thinking. Like, maybe that is what they're going for there.
Oh, and I don't think so. Yeah. It certainly seemed it to me.
And yeah, I didn't know. I didn't pick up on that.
Yeah, she wins him over ultimately. So it's like,
how does she win him over? That was the part that felt a little rushed.
Well, because she calls out she calls out what patriarchal attachment is about, which is power, control, and stuck roles. Whereas the attachment she comes back around to in the third chapter, in the third act, is the attachment of love, the attachment of heart, which is much more supple, much more flexible, much more empathic, you know, whereas in patriarchal society, what we think of as love relationships were duty relationships, obligation relationships. You know, in honor society, It was about holding up the structure of roles, as opposed to what we're trying to learn, you could say, in the Aquarian age or the post-1950s age. We're trying to learn how to have enduring attachments with each other that are not based on playing roles, but are based on deep understanding of each other. It's a much harder problem.
And I think these are sort of two fundamental answers to the question of chaos or the problem of chaos.
Yes.
Right. His answer is reduce the chaos down as much as you can, control it as much as you can, and then you have stability and order and some amount of functionality. Whereas the love approach has to be more flexible because it has to be an accepting of the chaos, of all the possibilities, even the ones in which people suffer and there is harm and that sort of thing. So,
and that's where the absurdism comes in, because there has to be that flexibility.
And the vulnerability. Right. Mm-hmm. Like flexibility has to mean vulnerability, which is something that the like authoritarian mindset struggles with alongside open mindedness. Right. Like the openness to those things. I think you could argue at least that like the fear of open mindedness in those mindsets often comes from a fear of being embarrassed because things don't go the right way. And so you create the structure in which you can ensure that things will go a way that we accept as being sufficiently right, rather than letting things kind of go wild and explore.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And that's why humor doesn't appear well in those societies. Humor has to be based on that kind of flexibility. You know, that's why totalitarians don't create great comedy. That's why Trump can never, ever make or laugh at a joke. Because I don't think they can bear the vulnerability, you know? I mean, kings would have court jesters who would make fun of them, but it was pretty well circumscribed, you know? And I'm sure that more than a few court jesters lost their heads when they got a little too close to the bone. But that's what happens when you break out into that kind of freer, more tender enlightenment is everything can be a joke at that point, because nothing matters quite that much.
Yeah, this to me was one of the core insights of Discordian style absurdism, which I think is prevalent in this as well. And it's the kind of the rejection of the sacred, where sacred means something you can't laugh at.
Yes.
You know, everything is on the table for laughing. And that's the way that we don't turn into a bad kind of cult, is we don't take anything seriously.
Yep.
But that can, you know, that comes with its own risks, right? You end up laughing at the wrong things. You end up laughing at morality in ways that I think is not always ideal. But I do think that there is a transcendent insight there that is valuable. I realize we're already going long on the exposition. I feel like we mostly already talked them about the end.
We merged the show into an everything bagel of exposition and philosophy.
Well, I was going to say, you know, we mostly covered the part at the end last time when we talked about your concerns, I feel like, on the, you know, how well do they really address this back in the real world, right? Not the level of my conceptual abstraction, but at the level of real human beings, which I do think is an important part of the discussion. So I was going to say maybe we could just... unless there's any other moments that anybody wanted to highlight, we could hop over and do a little bit of formal philosophy as well as some more informal.
I wore my formal philosophy suit. I don't know.
There you go.
Goodbye.
You want to give me a grok it then?
Yeah, you should definitely go ahead and grok it.
Why don't you just tell me the right answer?
Well, that's what's so great about the trolley problem is that there is no right answer.
This is why everyone hates moral philosophy professors.
Let's talk about a couple of things. I think there's, again, everything in here, and some of it is tying back to things we've discussed on the show before, but one thing that I want to talk about that's new in my continued endless obsession with the concept of luck. I think it's fair to talk about this movie and luck because I do think there's a bunch of luck symbolism in the movie, and it's about, you know, luck relationships. But one thing that I thought would be really useful to discuss is there's a definition of luck in philosophy that is particularly tricky to understand, but this one gives a really good, you know, version of it essentially. So for folks who have not heard previous discussions about this, there are like three versions of luck that I think that are sort of dominant in the philosophical literature right now. One of them is the kind of chance account of luck, which is one that a lot of us intuitively have at least as part of our understanding of it. So this is things that are really unlikely or really random. And then there's the control account, which is one that I'm always hammering on about, where it's like you don't have control in the kind of sense necessary for moral responsibility, just desserts, that sort of thing. There's this other account, though, raised by this guy, Pritchard in particular, who's actually primarily an epistemologist, and this comes out of discussions of epistemic luck. He argues for what he calls a modal account of luck. So what that means is it has to do with these concepts of modalities, like, you know, what was the likelihood that something would happen? What do we mean when we say that there's a likelihood that something would happen? One way to talk about this in philosophy is this possible worlds thing that we've talked about before, comes up a lot, right?
Very early episodes of the show.
Right. This is calling back again to Rick and Morty stuff too, right? They did a lot of good work on this front as well. And his account of luck relies on the same kind of version of possible worlds that you see in Frankfurt, where the idea is you have the actual world and then you have like the worlds, the nearby possible worlds is what they call them, where those are like slightly different than ours. So if, you know, if we imagine the possible worlds each being one where some small difference in, you know, one person's behavior or something like that, and then farther out from those, you have the really distant possible worlds. And I love this movie because it does a great job, I think, of like conveying what distant possible worlds would be like with the like hot dog hands and stuff.
Oh, I thought that was a close by one. That's just changing one thing, which is your fingers.
Well, so I mean, I think that also highlights that like this is a highly intuitive, despite being a philosophical approach, is often a very like just so-y intuitive. I feel like, what do we mean by close and near and far possible worlds, right? Is the hot dog hand one really close, relatively speaking, or, you know, is it, is anything that even remotely resembles ours really close relative to like the vast number of worlds in which there's nothing, right? Again, the rock worlds, the endless rock worlds. But I also like the idea of the jumping system in this one being possible worlds based, where it's like you have to get to the nearby possible worlds where you still have like cool abilities, you know, and you're like way off the map at some points. Okay, but the possible worlds account of luck would be this. Something is lucky insofar as it has what Pritchard calls modal fragility versus modal stability, I think, is the alternative. So the idea is, how many times does that thing happen in nearby possible worlds? And if the answer is not many, then it's a lucky or unlucky situation, essentially. So
it's probabilistic.
Well, yeah, so that's the interesting thing. He believes that his approach is separate from both the chance account of luck and the control account. He thinks that it's a different account.
Oh, yeah, it just sounds like the same to me.
I also think, it 100% collapses into those. What I think is interesting about it is that I think it highlights one of the ways in which we gain access to knowledge about luck. So what I think, then again, that's why I highlighted at the beginning that he's an epistemologist. What I think he's pointing out is that our ability to do counterfactual thinking, where we imagine what the nearby possible worlds would look like, and we realize that, like, in most of them, that, you know, when I go drunk driving, I do hit somebody or something bad happens. And so I'm very lucky if that doesn't happen, and that sort of thing. You know, that's how we at least gain some understanding of this concept that we call luck and what kinds of luck are happening, whose luck, where, etc. And then I think he takes it a step further and says, but this is also like a correct analysis of the definition of luck. And I think his argument, I think, would be either both the chance and the control account are insufficient in themselves, essentially, that you have to combine them together in modal fragility, which includes both control and chance.
How does it include both? Questions. I don't think I understand. It just sounds like chance to me. Yeah. I thought it was just the chance one.
Well, so I would say it includes both, actually, because So if you have more or less control over a situation, that's going to impact the modal fragility of that situation, right? So think about how control works.
Oh.
You know, if I have a situation where I can turn the random number generator down to just one number, what I've effectively done is just made it so that all nearby possible worlds, that's the number that's going to happen, right? So having maximal control over a situation equates to having maximal, you know, modal stability, essentially. So he would say that his system can account for, you know, the intuition that there's this control aspect of luck, but also that it can account for the intuition that luck is this thing where, you know, if something's really unlikely, then it's very lucky. Now, I argue against him and say, I think his view is parasitic on the control and the probability account, and that the probability account is also parasitic on the control account, that both probabilistic accounts of luck and the modal fragility account are ultimately just telling us about the way that we as monkeys gain access to knowledge about luck. They don't tell us about the nature of luck itself, and the reason is, I think there are cases where we would absolutely call something luck, but it's not modally fragile at all. It's very sturdy, and it's very likely, right? It's certain. It's near certain. And some of them have eventually basically had to say, yes, it might be the case that luck would apply to things that aren't necessarily modally fragile in this kind of way. So for example, if you inherit, you know, $1 billion from your parents, I would argue that that's not modally fragile. And if you end up in, you know, still rich when you die, having inherited all that money, that's also not modally fragile, but it would certainly seem to qualify as luck. Does that make sense?
I lost you.
I don't think that I understand the three well enough to distinguish the fine points of what you're talking about, quite honestly.
Well, it also, I feel like in common parlance, we use lucky a couple different ways, it seems to me. I mean, it seems like we sometimes we say, I'm very lucky in a way that means like, honestly, just good things have happened to me, rather than like rare,
good fortune.
Rare things have happened to me. I think those are two kind of maybe different ways we use that. I think there's some ways we say that we're lucky that don't mean they're rare per se. But I also feel like maybe what could be going on here is just the thing that we're applying the probability to is just different. So like this, I don't know what the control thing to me makes no sense. Cause it's like, okay, what were the odds that you had control over that thing? And how many, you know, like in how many local universes, whatever, did you have control over this factor? I can imagine very close by universes in which you might not have had control, whatever control means, I guess. And it feels like, as you've described, it feels like the account doesn't look at that end of it.
So I would say it takes it into account, but it sort of mixes it in with the chance stuff as well. So I wanted to mention, you know, and as part of doing the PhD stuff about luck, I have been reading a bunch of the psychology trying to analyze how people think about these different things, like descriptively, like what are the actual things people have in their minds? And first of all, I'm not sure that we actually know very well, because I'm sort of skeptical about the instruments that we have to measure the distinctions between people's beliefs in luck versus good fortune, for example. And our mutual friend Lindsay Osterman and I are working on some of this kind of stuff research wise. So hopefully we'll have some more of that down the line eventually. But it is absolutely true that our use of luck is messy and incoherent, and often in internally inconsistent for individuals.
Yeah.
And includes references to things like chance, but also this weird conflation of luck and lucky, where lucky means good luck specifically or good fortune, but also things like destiny, fate, all of these ideas, blessed, all get mixed in weird ways. But just talking about the philosophical side of things for a second, just setting aside the usage side, which is a big problem. I think ultimately everything can be captured just in a discussion of control, because the modal fragility you know, ultimately comes down to what amount of control you have over something. When we say that something is chancy, what we are partly, at least, I think crucially saying is it's not under your control, right? A random number generator is not under your control, and that's what makes it luck. And so those, you know, like those things give us awareness of when lucky things happen, but they don't, they aren't an essential, the true essential feature of luck. And the, on the modal account, one other thing I'll add, they have to ultimately acknowledge that the actual conscious decision or the actual conscious awareness of the possible worlds, right? The counterfactual thinking that goes into realizing that you are experiencing luck isn't actually necessary. They can't claim that it's necessary because there are going to be situations where we would classify an event as luck, but no one has conscious awareness of the fact of the counterfactuals or any of that kind of stuff, right? So the example that I use in the paper is, you know, imagine you have a baby who like narrowly avoids death and like no adult is around to see it happen, right?
Did it even make a sound?
We would classify... Right. Did it even make it? Is it even lucky? And I think they have to say, yeah, it is. It's good luck.
Yeah, definitely.
But there's no counterfactual judgments. What they have to then say is, well, hypothetically, an ideal observer or the right kind of observer in the right situation would recognize.
Oh, I didn't realize any of this was predicated on someone like making a guess about the luck of it. Why do you need an observer?
Well, they have to clarify that because initially, you know, their initial sort of account of it, it was ambiguous as to whether the counterfactual thinking was necessary in the actual world or just would hypothetically occur. And I think by pushing it back to the hypothetical, what they're showing is, again, this is not an account of the essential features of luck itself. It's an account of how we gain understanding of that thing. By thinking about these kinds of possible worlds, we might understand that something was particularly lucky or unlucky, but we don't need to do that. And modal fragility itself, I don't think, is an essential feature of all lucky events. I think there are events that we can, you know for 100% certainty are going to happen, and they still count as luck. So that means that it can't either be either the probability account or the modal fragility account. And all that's left then, I think, is the control account.
Oh, that's interesting. Obviously, you're more steeped in this, and I'm just hearing your explanation. But to me, it feels like, and I actually would have guessed based on your kind of philosophy that you would have said that it all collapses down to the probabilistic account, because I don't really, earlier you said that something being not lucky, well, let me make sure I have it right, but you said that something is not lucky if it's under our control, I think you said, and that was the distinction you were drawing.
Something is lucky if it's not under our control.
Right. So,
and something is not lucky if it's under our control in the relevant sense.
Okay. Because I could see something being, because I feel like I could come up with exceptions to that. Like if we're doing the random number generator thing and I have no control over what number is the winner, I could see a world in which I'm drawing one out of a billion or I'm drawing one out of two. And I have no control over which of those, but the luck is greatly changed depending on which one it is.
The probability is greatly changed. I would say the luck would be, are you in the world in which you only have to pick between two numbers versus a billion numbers? So another big problem with the modal fragility view is that if our goal at the end of the conversation about luck is to hang moral responsibility and just desserts on people, which is where these free will conversations, I think, do ultimately all... Like that's where it applies back to reality, right? That's where it comes back to what we have to do in the actual world. And there, I think this account tells us nothing, because you can't hold people morally responsible for what's not under their control. And one thing that I think we can all agree is not under our control is which world we ended up in, right? Like you don't get to choose what's the actual world versus all of the many possible worlds. You might have some influence on causal influence
Does
on the
that
world.
Not undermine the entire control model for any single thing you're talking about. You could say, well, you were lucky to be in the world in which you had control.
Right.
So that's why
I have
like
a no control view of luck.
The control view of thing, but it,
Yeah.
I don't get it.
Oh, it should technically be called the no control view in the sense that, like, I ultimately think it's luck all the way down because we don't have control over any of this.
Maybe I misunderstood.
Right? So what do we do in that situation? And that's again, brings us to that kind of nihilistic precipice. And you have to figure out, and that's where I think we can talk before we run out of time here about the googly-eyed kind of enlightenment, this sort of absurdist approach to the opening of the third eye, where you still choose to value things, right? The line about I'll cherish these few specks of time. And also the universal love kind of approach of this recognizing that you are everyone in every situation, everywhere. Mm-hmm. I do feel like there's kind of almost a cliche-ness to that. But I really do think that it is a deeply valuable practice in a sense.
Oh, yes.
That, like, you know, in the same, you know, it's interesting to me because realizing that you are in all of the relationships with everyone, everywhere, in all situations throughout all of time, in a radical sense, in a genuinely full-on radical sense, is the thing that potentially produces the crisis of meaning, the nihilism, the, like, what's the point? If, like, it's everything is playing out everywhere, why does any one of those things matter? But it's also the point at which the Buddhists think you can become genuinely compassionate towards everyone everywhere, because you realize that you are them in another moment in time, in another place, or something like that. Mm-hmm. And again, this is the recognition of the universality of luck, right? It's the difference of the luck of which reality that person is in right now versus the one that you're in right now. And it is kind of this view from nowhere. And I like the idea that, like, Jobu, in a sense, is the madness that comes from trying to really hold all of those relations in your mind in that kind of way. But I think that at the end of the day, we can do something like this in a way that does actually engender compassion. Maybe, you know, like, the limits of our cognition are such that we really can't conceptualize every single relationship. Mm-hmm. But it's similar, I think, in the way that the Buddhist practice of, like, looking inwardly and saying, I recognize I'm having this emotion, but I am not that emotion. I recognize that I'm having this thought, but I am not that thought. Looking outwardly and saying, I recognize that I am this person and this person and this tree and this rock and all of these things, mm-hmm. can change our psychology, can change how we treat ourselves and others.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the old spiritual cliche there, but for the grace of God, go I.
Or
that's what that means.
I am he is, as you are he is.
Exactly.
We are right. Together. Yep. Whatever.
It's exactly
all the things.
It's all those things.
I use their "but for the grace of God go I" when I give my luck talks for conservative audience.
Yeah,
or
sure.
Conservative,
I actually love,
you know,
that
to pitch it towards
phrase.
Conservatives.
Yeah, I do that too. I actually specifically use that phrase if I'm talking to some, trying to, like, appeal to some, you know, conservative religious person's sense of, like, hey, why do you feel like you are more deserving because you were born on some side of an imaginary line that a person wasn't born on? It's there, right. But for the grace of God go I is a fantastic way of putting it.
And I'll go you one further, to quote Bill Hicks again. You know, for folks who aren't familiar, please Google Bill Hicks talking about squeegeeing your third eye and psychedelics, because it's absolutely crucial to this conversation. But I don't want to
love Bill Hicks, and I got to refresh on that. I'm sure I've seen it. I got to refresh on that one. I love Bill Hicks.
Probably his best bit of all time. But, you know, on the, like,
for me, it's we can't put that.
You know, this is the other, the idea of love the sin or hate the sin, which I think we all have in the real world, I think, somewhat of a negative reflexive reaction to, because we actually don't think that people actually follow through on it. We think, great idea, but you're not actually doing that. You seem to really be hating the sinner pretty
and
hard.
And only certain sinners that you've decided resonate more.
Right. But this is my view when I say I believe that moral realism is true, but moral responsibility is not, and is fault and doesn't exist and should be jettisoned, right? What I'm saying is the sin is bad, right? The harming of others is bad, objectively bad, should be prevented, should be corrected for universal salvation. No one deserves to suffer, right? But the sinner is blameless, right? The sinner is just luck. And they're just along for the unlucky ride of being on that side of this particular exchange in this particular moment.
Absolutely.
That's and this Yeah, go ahead.
No, that's just a dead on, you know, spiritual enlightenment, you know, when Jesus says, forgive them, they know not what they do, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the core of real spiritual enlightenment, is realizing there but for the grace of God go I am he, as she is he, we are all the same. I mean, it's all there. Yeah. Right. That's why you can't.
And that's what everyone took away from the crucifixion story.
Unfortunately,
just
not.
That. Only yeah. That. No. Well, this also, I think, brings us to the thing we talked about after dark about, does moral luck ruin art? Because in the universal salvation view, it's hard to have villains. And, I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing. I do think it's better that we have less, you know, ridiculously two-dimensional villains that are used to, like, you know, externalize and scapegoat and things like that. And then at the same time, I do feel like, how many more movies do I need to see of everyone in the movie having an abusive past and the moral conclusions being completely ambiguous before I might, you know, want just like a straightforward morality tale, a little bit of Marvel again, essentially, right? Just go back to punching
sometimes you just want
bad
orcs.
Thing until it's good again.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just got to punch some bad stuff. But I do think that this, like, what I think is in art, we are seeing this reflection of our greater awareness of these sort of circumstantial and constitutive kinds of luck. And it's making it harder for us to demonize people in our art, which may be a good thing. Like, maybe it means we have crappier art, but we have.
Oh, no, I think it's better.
Better people.
Are we? Is this a
I think it is
thing
generally
we wanted
art.
To do now yeah. or after dark?
Oh, I was just mentioning.
Yeah,
it,
no,
know,
I just wanted to clarify if you
could...
were introducing it for an After Dark topic or.
Oh, no, it was something we talked about previous After Dark that we were going to mention in the main segment on this one. And
I don't have any of these same worries. A, because the clear villain of this movie was the main character. But B, because. But
boy,
B,
you've really,
because.
Really got a heart
attached, attached to the bitter end.
I just know how to trigger her. No, I'm just kidding. No, I genuinely believe that. She sucks. But I think that it's good to get rid of cartoony villains, or as you said, I mean, sometimes they have their place if you make just, space bad guy like every Marvel movie. But I don't think you run any risk of losing out on real villains if even with a sophisticated view of moral luck. I think that there's infinite space for stories of people who have misaligned priorities. Maybe one of them is factually wrong about a thing and they're put at odds, you know, like I think about something like the abortion debate. As much as it's easy to be like, okay, yeah, pro-lifers are the clear villains. And I think they, for more or less are, but like, if you really believed abortion was murder, then in some ways that is still a conflict where it's like, yeah, I mean, they just are wrong about a thing. But like, also, they're still the villain. You know what I mean? Those two things, I think, to me, can exist pretty easily.
Fair enough. Yeah, I do think that it doesn't destroy. I think it's something that we have to be aware of. But these are just sort of concerns that I've seen some folks potentially laying out versions of them. Essentially, I know we're running short on. We're going a little over here, but I was going to tie in one more thing, maybe just to wrap us up. Which is, while I was also planning my convalescence for the getting my third eye squeegeed, I decided to finally listen to the audiobook of Siddhartha, which I had never read or
read
listened to
school.
Despite, you know, I had enough people told me, you know, you kind of actually should have, like, if you're going to do this shtick, you should actually
have read
this. I'm
surprised. What the hell? How have you not?
Right. There's a lot of I'm surprised, but you know, when you're doing other versions of that, like Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, it just never came up. Anyway, but I did listen to it, which I enjoyed because, as somebody described it, it is very much like the Buddhist version of Life of Brian. I liked the way that it talked about this debate in the movie and that we've been talking about, where it's living in the world versus escaping from attachment. Mm-hmm. That, like, there is a traditional Buddhist path. I've talked about it before. I think the Arhat path, where, you know, the goal is just escape from samsara for yourself, right? You get out. You are freed from attachment. You stop reincarnating. But the more common approach is the Bodhisattva path, which is the, I choose to be reincarnated despite having become enlightened so that I can free everyone else from enlightenment as well. And I just, you know, I think of in the real world, right, taking this all as metaphorical model, right, the bodhisattva path is the question of how do I live in the world and act well without the wrong kind of attachment? And you end up kind of trying to find this, like, what they call grasping without attachment. And I think this movie is a lot of trying to manage that relationship. And, you know, maybe we don't always even know if we've, you know, found the right balance. I don't think we do know. I think that's one of those kind of ethical questions where we'll die not knowing if we worked that out the right kind of way. And I think about it with, like, the daughter and the mother, where, like, the mother is pulling towards the daughter is pulling away, even in rock form. And, like, there's a codependence there that could be really toxic. How do you know when you're doing the right kind of grasping without attachment versus not? I think that is part of our art, is the struggling with that in a bunch of different forms.
Mm-hmm. I think that it was covered best in our episode on Avatar: The Last Airbender. I think that
that's right.
Aang almost reached the super avatar state, and then he still was attached to Katara. So there you go. That's all you need to know.
Mm-hmm. All right. I guess we should probably leave it
there. Why you didn't read Siddhartha? Because you were just reading Avatar: The Last Airbender. You're like, I don't need to read two things. That was
just
the same.
Just the same thing.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there. A little more After Dark to come. But before we do that, why don't you tell us what our top patrons are making you say this time?
As a human, I was ill-equipped to thank you. But as myself, you have my everlasting gratitude.
Yeah, thanks to our strong AI patrons. I promise we'll get back to real science fiction here in a second. Alex Beneshek, Coffee and Antidepressants is Not Breakfast, Big Easy Blasphemy, Bickering About Morals is My Kink, Wink Wink. Oh my God, that was my worst patron name ever. I kept it for 2 months. That one's getting particularly ironic now. Dude, Corey Ebert, Jesta, Neil Polzin is now an elected official. Learn more at neilforcovina.com. Jesse Urbanowitz and Brenda Goodman and Alex Arnett. And all the thanks to our absolutely, definitely, pretty sure you're not a clone or the one living in the primary universe patrons. Ice Cube or Ice Tea, I'm not sure.
Wait a minute, Jess, did you bribe your way onto this show? No, I'm just kidding. Is this pay to play?
So, he played a really long game.
Do we need to have a congressional hearing about this?
And indoctrinating
right.
them
in
into...
so many ways. It's part of my long, long game.
And
yeah, he went the Bene Gesserit approach to getting on a podcast.
That's right.
And what do we have a preview for next time on Philosophers in Space?
We do. We're going to get back to hard sci-fi and real world issues. We're going to talk about Orville, the New Horizons, a.k.a. season 3. There have been a couple of spicy episodes in this season, and we're in particular going to talk about episodes 5 and 8. And we're going to talk about the queer theory moral panic that's been going on and continues to be happening in the world. And also the ethics of things like parental consent with regard to gender identity, etc. So going to get back into other controversial things.
Wow. Yeah. Should be easy breezy. Yeah. Okay.
Right.
Well, that's our show. We'll see you for that.
Way easier than absurdism.
Well, we'll see you for that episode, normies. For everybody else, for patrons, we'll see you after dark right now.
This has been a burst transmission of Philosophers in Space. All music written and performed by Thomas Smith. If you've enjoyed your infotainment upload, please locate the nearest podcast interface device and fill it with 5-star ratings and glowing reviews. If you think Ground Control should spring for fun new goodies and content, consider supporting us at patreon.com/zeroG. You can find us on Twitter at zeroG Philosophy, where Aaron will instantly and compulsively respond. Or you can email us at philosophersinspace@gmail.com. Finally, if you're sad that it takes so long for our signals to reach Earth, you can always find Thomas over at Serious Inquiries Only and Opening Arguments, and Aaron over at Embrace the Void. Until next time, live long and philosopher.